We should never claim that the ultimate evil of the Holocaust was caused by Germans alone. There are more perpetrators. A statement by historian Hans Blom. He was director of the NIOD, the Dutch War Institute. He said that we do not do history justice if we do not name that besides the well-known Nazi leaders, there were also others who collaborated in the persecution of the Jews.
Who was actually prosecuted for the ultimate evil, for the death of more than 170,000 people in Sobibor? How did that go? Are the responsible parties truly punished?
This is The Silence of Sobibor, a podcast series in which we investigate the stories from this extermination camp where so many people were murdered. Can we supplement those stories? Does the image of Sobibor needs to be adjusted? We are podcast makers Patty Lou Middellenier and Richard Grootbot from Audio Dream Podcast Productions from the Netherlands, and we're producing this series in collaboration with the Sobibor Foundation. This is episode 5, Trailblazer for Justice.
Something strange happens as we get older. The past pulls you back and sometimes disrupts the present. Psychologists say that invisible rubber bands run through your memories. You drink a cup of coffee and suddenly you think of the cup that stood in the cupboard at your grandma's. You immediately remember on which shelf it stood, how it smelled, and that the cupboard door creaked. The rubber band pulls you back into the past. But what if a random event, a sound or a smell, keeps pulling you back to that one place, that one day? What if almost all rubber bands in your head lead back to 14th of October 1943, to the day of the uprising in Sobibor?
That happened to Samuel Lehrer. He is one of the prisoners who was able to flee from the camp. Both his brothers are shot dead that day. On his escape, he cannot go back to help them. He must keep running. You heard Samuel already in the previous episode. He is the man who said that he often has nightmares about Sobibor. Years later, the memories of Sobibor pull him back at night, back into the past.
I still dream about them. I still dream about Wagner and Frenzel and the rest of them.
Samuel is not hit during the uprising, and he runs straight through the minefield to the forest edge. Between the trees, he sees others, like Esther Raab, who also made it. Together they hide. They manage to survive the war.
1 year after the war in Berlin, Samuel Lehrer walks down the street. Everywhere, reconstruction work is taking place. Along the side of the road, men are clearing rubble from a building that was bombed in the war. One of the men is picked up by his wife and also walks down the street. Samuel looks the man in the face and he recognizes him immediately. It's Erich Bauer, the man who in Sobibor operated the engine that provided the deadly exhaust gas in the gas chambers. Samuel has found the man who is called the Gasmeister of Sobibor.
I saw Bauer walking with his wife, arm in arm. I almost fainted. I almost dropped dead. Two policemen were walking and said, "Arrest this man. Arrest him." They arrested him.
Together with Esther Raab, who Samuel still knows from the camp and who also lives in Berlin, he identifies the Gasmeister in the police cell later that day. 4 years later, in 1950, Bauer is sentenced to death by a court, a sentence that is ultimately commuted into life imprisonment.
His conviction does not make much impression in the Dutch media. Just like the reading public, the newspapers are not interested in looking back at the war. A Dutch newspaper writes about Erich Bauer on page 12 in a three-line message. Erich Bauer, a 50-year-old former SS officer, has been sentenced to death by a West Berlin court. He is accused of having gassed hundreds of thousands of Jews. In this message, the name of Sobibor is garbled into Solibor. The communist daily, De Waarheid, places an equally short message about the conviction, but just below the news that the railway staff in Finland has ended the strike. They get 7% wage increase, it says.
The trial against Bauer does trigger a search for other Sobibor camp guards. When people realized what horrors had happened there, they went looking for the others, says Samuel. He and Esther Raab are also summoned as witnesses in those trials.
They found Gomerski, they found Frenzel, and they started calling us to the trials. I testified, and the first one was in Hagen. That was at the Frenzel, Bolander, Stoibel. The next one was in Frankfurt against Gomerski and against Clear. And later on, they brought in the commandant from Brazil, Stangl.
A special case is that against Franz Stangl, who was arrested in Brazil after investigation by the well-known Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal.
But with that, the trials are not over. Some try, after years of prison sentences, via a new trial to get free after all. Lehrer, who is meanwhile emigrated to America, boards the plane again to testify.
20 years later, they called us again to retrials because they appealed. All those SS men appealed to let them free. So they called us again at trials again to the same people, the same SS. Some of them got put back to jail, some of them got freed.
Where the case against Erich Bauer is still dismissed with a few lines in the newspapers, the case against Franz Stangl in 1970 already gets much more attention. Dozens of reports in Dutch newspapers alone speak about the case. Some articles are pages long. I only did my duty, says Franz Stangl in the trial. Later on, he's interviewed in his cell for a book that is called Into That Darkness. In it too, he sticks to the position that he only carried out orders, orders he couldn't evade.
But the trial that would surpass all others' immediate attention is that against a man who is picked up in Cleveland in the American state of Ohio. He's suspected of having been a Zugwachtmann, someone who, upon arrival of the trains, made sure everyone got out as quickly as possible. Compared to the other convicted persons, he's a small fish. His name would appear all over the world in the media in the years after his arrest.
Shinoni Sud, ja, Jan Demjanjuk.
It is a well-known photograph on an identity card from the war that has been found back. There is a man with deep-set eyes. His hair is buzzed. Augenfarbe grau. The color of his eyes is gray, as stated on the card. His neck is almost completely hidden in black, in the high collar of his uniform. The identity document states that he works at the Sobibor camp, and his name is on it. John Demjanjuk.
In Cleveland, he had lived for years under the radar until in 1985 the police show up at his door to question him about possible involvement in war crimes in Poland. He is extradited to Israel. There, Demjanjuk has to defend himself against the charge that he is Ivan the Terrible, a camp guard who is in the extermination camp Treblinka, who mistreated Jewish victims and sent them to the gas chambers. The prosecutor reads the charge.
John, you're being accused of being at Treblinka and participating in the horrendous crimes at that death-killing camp. Would you tell the court at this instance what your answer is with regard to you ever being at that location and perpetrating any of these crimes?
І цьому найсправедливіший свідок, я є невинний, невинний і невинний.
As God is my witness, says Danyamyuk, I am innocent, innocent, innocent. The hearing is interrupted several times by jeering from the audience until the judge tells those present to be quiet.
He is a murderer, shouts someone from the public.
But an important witness has given contradictory statements. He had previously stated on paper that he killed Ivan the Terrible during the 1943 uprising. In the courtroom, he retracts that, and there is doubt about the authenticity of the photograph. Is this really Ivan? Initially, Demjanjuk is sentenced to the gallows, but on appeal, he's acquitted.
We rule that Bachman Demjanjuk is innocent. Today, July 29th, 1993, we see that a human judge cannot be perfect, says the Israeli Chief Justice.
One thing stands out. How often the evidence against Demjanjuk points in another direction, toward Sobibor.
Demjanjuk may be one of the most famous names, but there were many others too. Those names are only known to a few people today, like Odilo Globochnik. Good chance you've never heard that name before. Globochnik was ultimately responsible for Treblinka, for Belzec and Sobibor. From behind his desk, he exterminated people as if they were fleas.
His career began in Vienna, where he initially rose quickly within the Nazi Party. But when financial disorder and corruption were discovered under his leadership, he was removed. His career seemed over until Heinrich Himmler, by then one of the most important Nazi leaders, summoned Globochnik. He gets a second chance from Himmler, which he seizes with both hands.
Himmler heeft hem betrokken bij de endlösung van de
Willem Hendrik Gispen, who together with illustrator Jeroen Hermkens wrote a book called Name Their Names. In it, he describes his travels to the extermination camps and explains who was responsible there. That also covers the lesser-known names like Odilo Globochnik's. On October 15, 1941, Globochnik is in a meeting with Himmler.
Ze hadden het erover dat de Joden moesten nu echt.
They are discussing how the Jews now really had to be destroyed. They were doing it with Sonderkommandos behind the lines. But that wasn't fast enough. It could never be sufficient. Germans were breaking down mentally from the constant shooting. So they decided we need separate camps. The idea for the Aktion Reinhardt camps. It's often said it actually came from Globochnik. The book reveals a remarkable message from Globochnik in the High Command in Berlin. During a period of war with many troop movements, the extermination camps receive less fuel for the engines at the gas chambers. Globochnik sends a telegram to Himmler's adjutant.
The current reduction limits the execution on my part. Because large deliveries from abroad are currently coming in and activity will therefore increase, I request that you also take this aspect into account.
Willem Gispen writes in his book, "This is how a man who runs a murder factory reasons when he's cut on production capacity, just when he's expecting large deliveries." That word alone, Jews as raw material in the mass extermination process that Globochnik wants to carry out as efficiently as possible.
And he says, with Globochnik, you see that he already approaches the extermination process in a business-like manner, so he essentially says, I need more fuel to gas more Jews.
Meer Joden te kunnen vergassen.
Before the war, Lublin had 120,000 inhabitants, 43,000 of whom were Jewish. Globocnik first locks them into ghettos, then deports them to Belzec. After the war, only 300 Jewish residents of Lublin remain alive. The numbers are terrifying. Globocnik uses gravestones from a Jewish cemetery for road construction. Everything, including Jewish history, is cleared away, is erased.
This book by Willem Gispen and Jeroen Hermkens also shows how important the T4 Aktion was for the extermination camps. T4 stood for Tierengartenstrasse 4 in Berlin, the headquarters of the widespread project to gas everyone with a disability or mental illness. This was based on the idea that the Aryan race had to be kept pure, even if none of the conditions were genetically transmissible. Later, political prisoners were also killed in the gas chambers. This happened in institutions in Germany and Austria. More than 70,000 people were murdered there. The T4 staff later formed the backbone of the extermination camps Sobibor, Belzec and Treblinka.
And one of them is SS man Gottlieb Hering, commandant of Belzec. He goes down in history as the man who devises a new kind of gruesome pastime for himself and for the camp's neighbors. He ties a Jewish prisoner to his car with a rope. Then the victim is forced to run behind the car while Hering drives back and forth through the village to the water pump in central Belzec. Behind the prisoner runs the camp commandant's large dog, trying to bite the victim. A pastime for the good people of Belzec.
About Globocnik, we read that he picks up where he left off elsewhere. In January 1944, when Sobibor and the other extermination camps are dismantled, he sends a message to Himmler. He reports that robbing the Jewish victims in Sobibor, Belzec and Treblinka together yielded around 180 million Reichsmark, a substantial source of income for the Nazis. The camps are dismantled and Globocnik is sent to Italy with a promotion to his birthplace Trieste. There he gets a similar role, this time at a place where partisans, resistance fighters and Jews are held, among others. The first thing he does is bring over as many people as possible from the former staff of Belzec Treblinka and his old headquarters in Lublin. Then a crematorium is built in the camp. Globocnik starts over.
At the end of the war, he flees under a false name, but he is captured by British soldiers. However, almost immediately after being recognized, in the early morning of May 31, 1945, Odilo Globocnik manages to take a suicide pill and he dies. The man who organized the murder of more than 1.5 million people dies.
The trial against another camp criminal does take place. The commander of Sobibor and Treblinka, Franz Stangl, appears before a judge. He receives a life sentence because he too participated in the murder of hundreds of thousands of Jews. Not long after his conviction, Stangl agrees to a series of interviews leading to a book about him. Journalist Gitta Sereni speaks with him for dozens of hours. He was a simple man who, even during the trial, never thought to imagine his own actions, Gita says about Stangl. That's exactly why she found his story interesting.
Because he had a world of experiences, which he had never thought of analyzing. And to be confronted with someone who analyzed what he said and played it back to him in a way, and it became very important to him. And to me, I mean, to understand how First of all, of course, how these people became what they became. How this devotion to the Nazis existed.
In the conversations with the journalist, Franz Stangl still tries to maintain that he is not an anti-Semite. He, too, repeatedly said he had no choice. He received orders and was threatened from above, but in the relative isolation of the forests around Sobibor, Stangl actually had extra room to maneuver, making his reasons for doing what he did even more important.
He denied, of course, fervently, that anti-Semitism had anything to do with it. And I'm not so sure that it was very important to him. I think it was more important to him that, that Hitler was an Austrian. but of course he was an anti-Semite too.
The mere fact that Hitler, like Stangl, came from Austria proved much more important.
Stangl, like so much of his staff, also came from the T4 euthanasia program in Germany. After some hesitation, Stangl also admits knowing that besides people with illness or disabilities, political prisoners were also murdered in the gas chambers of the institutions. In the book, he explains that at some point he is summoned to report in Lublin near Sobibor. What he was going to do there only became clear to him when he had already arrived at the camp itself.
According to Stangl himself, he had little to do with the daily operations. He was often present himself at the arrival of the trains to see if everything went well there. Many prisoners stated that he enjoyed his powerful position. To Hitasirni, he says that he mainly led the staff, even though there were barely 25 SS men.
I asked him how much he had seen, you know, of this. And he told me how he once had gone and looked through a Guckloch, you know, a hole in a wall at a gas chamber. That's the only time he had ever been in touch with it. He was way, it sounds absurd, but he was way above it.
I was an organizer, he says, and Sereni believes him.
The further you get into the book, Into That Darkness, the more of a sense of guilt seems to take hold of Stangl. He says, I was there, and my crime is that I am still here. I should have been dead too.
The book has a very bitter ending. A few hours after the last conversation, Franz Stangl suffers a heart attack in his cell and dies. This is 6 months after his conviction.
Another SS man from the Sobibor camp is also tracked down. Gustav Wagner, the deputy commandant. He was sentenced to death in Nuremberg in absentia, but he flees, together with Stangl, and ends up in Brazil. The list of stories about Wagner is long, and almost all incidents are gruesome. He murdered children in front of their parents. He forced a boy to hang his own father. He pressed two people's head together to see if he could kill them with one bullet. Samuel Lehrer describes him as the most cruel person I've ever known.
To describe it in a short time is very difficult because he was something that I don't think anybody can match him, can equal him. He was the most brutal person I have ever known.
Esther Raab, who also survived Sobibor, says about Wagner, he had been given the right to decide whether you should live or die.
Wagner had the right to decide if you should live or you should die, and how long you should live, and how soon you should die. That was Wagner.
Other survivors also describe him as an unpredictable man, someone who is very dangerous.
In the 1970s, Gustav Wagner is tracked down in Brazil by Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal.
Von den allen Schlägen, die mir in meiner ganzen sozusagen Karriere seit dem Kriege bekannt sind, zähle ich Gustav Wagner zu den schlimmsten. Was für mich der schlimmste ist, war für die SS der beste.
I see him as one of the very worst I got to know in my position after the war. The worst for me was the best for the SS, says Wiesenthal about Gustav Wagner.
But the Brazilian judge decides that Wagner does not need to be extradited. A TV crew tracks him down and interviews him. I had no feelings about it. It was just the job, he says about what he did in Sobibor. Not long after, he's found dead, killed by stabbing wounds. Suicide is the official explanation, but questions around Wagner's death remain up till now. Either way, his death ensures another trial cannot proceed. Then, in 2009, a second trial against John Demjanjuk begins. In the first case, in Israel, he is suspected of being a camp guard in Treblinka, but there is insufficient evidence. In this case, he is suspected of crimes in Sobibor. He has no high rank there, and as a war criminal, you could call him a small fish compared to other convicted Nazis. He's not a leader like Lobotnik or Stangl, but he is directly involved in the death of the people who had to get out of the trains in Sobibor during the time he worked there. Demjanjuk didn't sit behind the desk. He actually whipped people out of the trains. Like with the first train he sees to arrive in Sobibor on his first workday, April the 2nd, 1943. 1,255 people are in it, and Demjanjuk helps to ensure that no one from that train survives the day. It becomes his daily work, just until before the uprising in Sobibor. Demjanjuk was transferred a few weeks before the uprising. He isn't there.
Eli Rosenbaum is head of the office that tries to track down fugitive Nazis like Demjanjuk in the United States. He spoke, among others, with people who managed to escape during the uprising in Sobibor. In their statements, you keep hearing the same sentence, says Eli Rosenbaum in a speech. They keep saying, you can't imagine it.
Those survivors almost always end up telling us the same exact thing. They say three words, you can't imagine. Over and over again, the survivors who try to recount for us the demented bestiality of what they made us see, of what they did to us. And again, they say, you can't imagine it.
The more he looks at the evidence in the John Demjanjuk case, the more convinced he becomes that Demjanjuk may not have been in Treblinka, but is guilty of other war crimes in Sobibor.
There is no doubt he was a guard at the Sobibor death camp. To allow such a person to go unprosecuted would be to say, in effect, that the crimes don't matter, they're not important.
In America itself, Demjanjuk cannot be prosecuted because the crimes were not committed in the U.S. But when he is deported to Germany, that could happen. And so Demjanjuk boards a plane again, but now to Germany.
In Germany, there's a legal option where citizens can stand alongside the prosecutor in a trial like this. They then become co-plaintiffs, Nebenkläger. And one of the people who does that is Dutch survivor of Sobibor, Jules Schelvis.
Als Nebenkläger bin ich stolz darauf in diesem Saal.
I am proud to hold my plea in this hall in Munich as a co-plaintiff, says Jules Schelvis. And I do it because I owe it to my wife, Rachel, and countless other murdered relatives. Jules Schelvis is not only a co-plaintiff, but is also an expert in the case. His books about Sobibor have been clearly making a big impression. He sits right at the front of the courtroom. Pronouncing that statement in court went differently than I thought, said Jules. I thought, I'm not emotional before starting. It's all on paper, nothing can go wrong, but the moment you speak it aloud, you try to focus solely on the text, not what's behind it. If you let that in, you might as well stop. It just can't be done. I tried. It almost worked. But when I finished, the tears finally came into my eyes. For the loss, for everything that happened to me, for the loved ones murdered here.
de tranen om het verlies van alles wat er is gebeurd en mijn geliefden die daar zijn vermoord.
In the courtroom, Zhu pleads that Demjanjuk be declared co-responsible for the death of everyone who was gassed while they were in Sobibor. But from the humanistic background of his family, he asked the judge not to impose a prison sentence.
Ik heb gezegd dat hij veroordeeld moet worden, maar zonder.
I said he must be convicted, but without imposing a sentence. Look, that man has already been in prison for 9 years. That man is old. He could have been my grandfather, who, by the way, was also murdered in Sobibor. From my humanistic conviction, I believe that there should always be a possibility to not get the sentence he actually deserves. You must leave open a possibility to still let him go free, because I think that all those years he sat in the courtroom, he knows for himself that he is guilty, and it probably haunts him every day that he is guilty. In the end, John Demjanjuk is sentenced to 5 years in prison. He appeals, but while awaiting that trial, he dies. Demjanjuk's prison sentence was not the main goal of this case for me, says Jules Schelvis.
Ik vind het veel belangrijker.
I think it's much more important that the world knows what happened in Sobibor. If this trial had not taken place, Sobibor would have remained just as much in the dark as it was before. So that was my main point, and that was achieved.
Dat is mijn belangrijkste punt, en dat heb ik gescoord.
It may seem now that Jules Schelvis was only involved as co-plaintiff in the Demjanjuk trial, but in reality he had that role in many more trials. Journalist Kees Labeur often travelled with Jules and reported on the trials. He was amazed that Jules had the strength to tell his story every time.
Wij kunnen niet bevatten, ook zoals we hier zitten, wat daar is
gebeurd. Kees Labeur saw how Jules Schelvis grew into that role of co-plaintiff. It became a life's fulfillment, leading to more research and books now regarded as standard works on Sobibor.
Dit was een heel bijzondere mens, hoor.
Kees Labeur calls the way Jules Schelvis filled the role of co-plaintiff groundbreaking. He named Jules to be very special. They even became friends. Sometimes, he said, I would look at Jules like few people that could handle so much horror. He was so driven to do it. And on the other end, when I visited him, he could enjoy a slice of apple pie or the St. Matthew Passion. That was the man he was. He immersed himself in the Sobibor story that ultimately led to a standard work on Sobibor, a thick tome that was also translated into English.
That for the first time a Jewish survivor of a hellish camp had the last word in a courtroom with legal status. Groundbreaking. What happened there? That's why it's sour, says Kees Labeur, that Sobibor was completely unknown in the Netherlands for a long time. Few people knew the place where more than 34,000 fellow Jewish countrymen were murdered.
Als je nu nog met mensen over de Jodenvervolging spreekt en over de.
If you talk to people now about the persecution of Jews and concentration camps, the only thing they know, if anything, is Auschwitz, and the rest is not mentioned at all. I remember when Sobibor was completely unknown, a large survey in Germany, where there had already been a Sobibor trial, showed that most respondents thought Sobibor was a Spanish seaside resort. And the second answer was a new detergent. So that was the country of origin from the devilish murder work, and where there was no more attention than in the Netherlands. Yeah, that's how it went there.
Kees is shocked when he looks at the anti-Semitism that has reared its head once again several times in recent years. For example, in Amsterdam. It shows, according to him, the need not only to teach about the war in all schools, but especially about Sobibor.
Als je dan kijkt wat er voor rare golf van antisemitisme door zijn stad rolt.
And if you then look at what strange wave of antisemitism rolls through the city, then it becomes even more relevant to say, do you even know what happened? Never again. This must not happen ever again. So there's a real reason to keep bringing it into attention permanently, because after all these years, there is still antisemitism.
Antisemitisme is.
In Sobibor, the birds don't sing to this day, says one of the myths about the camp, but anyone who walks there immediately will hear that isn't true.
On the contrary, it seems like nowhere you hear the birds sing as loudly as here. The coniferous trees, partly planted under German supervision after the camp was closed, rustle constantly in the distance and provide a place for the birds. And yet, that myth persists. The truth is not always enough.
In February 2018, the Polish government introduced a new law, one that made it punishable to accuse Poles of complicity in the persecution of Jews. It was also forbidden to speak of Polish concentration camps. Violation of this law carried out a maximum penalty of 3 years in prison. A few months later, under immense international pressure, there was a change to the law and the violation was no longer seen as a crime. There are no penalties anymore. But the law itself was not withdrawn. It shows the difficult way Poland deals with war history.
The law, for example, contradicts the findings of research into the violence in the Polish town of Jedwabne. There in 1941, Polish villagers drove hundreds of Jews into a barn, which was then set on fire. The German occupiers had almost nothing to do with this act. It was a pogrom committed by the Poles alone. Rabbi Jacob Baker lived in Jedwabne at the time. It was a terrible day, he says in a TV documentary about the violence.
People were dragged out from their houses, men, women, infants, children. They were beaten on the way. In the barn, they were locked up and they spilled gasoline from the roof. And this fire, this scream was terrible. And people screamed so much, but the bojówki had music to extinguish the noise of cry.
He was not in the village that day and thus survived the pogrom. If the law had been enforced, the rabbi and the filmmaker would have gotten prison sentences for their documentary, while the perpetrators went free at the time.
Every episode of this podcast series ends with Ben Oranje. He writes poems, or spoken words, if you will. And just like you now, he has heard this episode. This is what he heard.
Reichleitner, Bauer, Wagner, Frenzel, Stangl, Kloboschnik, Demjanjuk. Men in grey at the gate. One witness remains. Gustav is shy, wobbles on 1 foot. Franz has closed his eyes again. Rudolf looks around. Eric at his fingers. Cannot wash off the black. Johan's looking picture perfect. Odilo is right at the front. Karel with hands on chest. Nobody knows why. John somewhat outside. Too gray for Spanish shore. Wearing a fragrance of fire and pine. Behind these newspaper headlines are still waiting hundreds aside. Four walls. Trials, release, knives, pills, cowardice, executions, 100 graves. He waits. One more person. Recognize them at once. Points them out calmly. Name by name. One by one. Now look in his small eyes. and listen to his voice. Daddy, Zach. The last words are of his choice.